I'm a grateful alcoholic. My name is George.
Hey, George.
Before I start tonight, first of all, I want to thank God, because without him, these 12 weeks never would have happened. And then I want to thank all the, I like to say I sit on the shoulders of many giants. There's many people that were here before I got here that really helped me through my journey. And that's what this has been. This has been a 12-week journey. And I don't know, a lot of things came out of it, and I hope I've touched one person's heart, because that's what I was taught that I needed to do. Besides my own, I know I've touched my heart. I got to see some things that I've done differently. I've got to relook at things through a new pair of lenses, as Chuck C. likes to talk about. Most of all, I want to thank all of you that stuck with me through this whole time, listening to a lot of my nonsense, because there's a part of me that still can't differentiate the truth from the false. Some of the things that I talk about, I really believe happened to me, and I don't know if they did or not. But in my mind, they're true, and I stick to that. That's just the way it is. That's the reality of my life. We started this journey with step one, and I want to jump to the 12th step, because I'm going to try and cover a lot of things tonight, which I always like to do, because I believe there's a lot of things that need to be covered. And when I got here, my sponsor said, you put out as much information as you can, because you don't know who you're going to touch and how they're going to be touched by what you put out. And you never know who you're helping. Before I get to the step, I want to talk about something that happened this morning. I got a phone call this morning from someone in Broward who I know for 16 years. And he called to say that, you know, I used to say to him, no matter what happens, just hang in there. I had 6 years of sobriety when I met him. That was like 13 years ago almost now. And he called me this morning to say, you know, I wanted to thank you, because I always heard your voice hollowing in my head saying, hang in there no matter what happens. And he called to tell me that today was 1 year anniversary. That's nothing that I did except to do what I was taught to do, was show up for another human being and practice the love that was given me to give it to someone else. I get all emotional with stuff like that, because I don't think I have anything to give. I still have that, I was told when I got in here, I am still an egomaniac with an inferiority complex, and I don't feel that I have helped anybody. I know that's a lie I tell myself, because I know I help a lot of people, but I don't believe it. Or I don't want to believe it. I don't know which it is yet. I haven't figured that one out. You know, the 12th step, and I'm going to talk about this 12th step. Each week I was trying to give you the promises of all the steps. I'm going to start off with all the promises in all 12 steps, because we don't talk about them a lot. And I want to talk about prayers, and I want to talk about the 12th step itself, the three parts, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. We try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. To me, that's three parts. We have a spiritual awakening and experience as the result of doing the steps. The message we carry, and I'll get into that, because there's a whole lot of messages we carry. And to me, it was the 12 steps. And it's about love and it's about hope. And then how do I practice these principles? So it's really three parts. But the journey took me to certain things. And the first thing I wanted to do is talk about all the promises in each step. There are promises in each step. There are promises throughout the big book. There are promises throughout the 12 and 12. And most of us only talk about the 9th step promises. My favorite is the 10th step promises, because it says Samuel will be returned, and I got a new gift because I never knew I was insane. In step one, our admission of powerlessness. Powerlessness turns out to be the firm bedrock upon which happy and purposeful lives can be built. So admitting that I was powerless over alcohol, I get a gift that I have a purposeful life now. And I get to that second step where I come to believe that a power greater than myself is going to restore me sanity. The promise of the second step is a true humility and an open mind can lead us to faith. And every AA meeting is an assurance that God will restore us to sanity if we rightly relate ourselves to him. Another promise. Third step promises. In the big book, we made a decision to turn our will and life over to the care of God as we understood him. We had a new employer being all powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, we enjoyed peace of mind. We discovered that we could face life successfully. We became conscious of his presence. We began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or hereafter. We were reborn. It's a pretty big promise. Four-step promise, you know, you make a moral inventory of ourselves. We have begun to learn to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward men, even our enemies, for we look at them as sick people. It's a nice promise in there. I don't have to be mad at my fellow man anymore because I can look at them as sick and suffering like I am. And there's a whole bunch of prayers in there that we got, and I'm going to talk about the prayers in a minute. Admitting to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs, our fifth step. Promise behind the fifth step, there's a bunch of them. We're delighted. We can look at the world in the eye. We can be alone in perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness to our Creator. We have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. We feel that the drink problem has disappeared, often comes strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Six and seven, they kind of put together, asking for our carried, knowing we have carried the defects and asking them to be removed in six and seven. And I like to say I built my house between six and seven. Those of us who have hitherto known only excitement, depression, or anxiety, in other words, all of us. So I'm not unique. We all got the same illness in here and the same human frailties. It says, this newfound peace is a precious gift. Something new indeed had been added. Where humility had formerly stood for force feeding of humble pie, it now begins to mean the nourishing ingredient which we can give us serenity. That's a nice promise on that one. Get to 8 and 9, making a list of the people we harmed, which we've got in our 4th step, and going in, trying to make the amends in the 9th step. When we do that, it tells us the 9th step promise, which we all know if we painstake about this phase of a development, be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity. We'll know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. I'm still waiting for that one. We'll intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We'll suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And it says they'll materialize if we work for them. Step 10, taking a daily inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admitting it. And that promptly used to be, I was listening to something I had said about 3 years ago, used to be a week, now it's about a day if I'm really bad with it. I'm a lot more prompt today than I was when I got here, and a lot faster than I was 3 years ago when I last time revisited that 10th step. And there's something that, there's some promises in the 10th step. It says we cease fighting anything and everyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We are seldom interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it like a hot flame. We act sanely and normally, and we find this has happened automatically. We'll see that a new attitude toward liquor had been given to us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We are not even sworn off. Instead, the problem had been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky, nor were we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. That's a real big promise. But there's a little hook in that. How do I keep in fit spiritual condition? Get to step 11. To seek through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood and praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. I prayed for all kinds of absurd things that I wanted God to do for me. A couple of the things that I prayed for never came true. I believe God answers all prayers three ways. He says yes, no, and wait. And before He'll give me a yes or no answer, He'll usually have me wait. Wait I usually do. And the answer will come. It may not be the answer I like, but it's always the one I need. And that's a gift that I've been given through patience, which is something I didn't have. And the promises in step 11 is one of the great rewards of meditation and prayer is a sense of belonging that comes to us. We are no longer living completely in a hostile world. We are no longer lost or frightened and purposeless. The moment we catch even a glimpse of God's will, the moment we begin to see truth, justice, and love as the real and eternal things in life, we are no longer deeply disturbed by all the seemingly evidence to the contrary that surrounds us in purely human affairs. We know that God lovingly watches over us, and we know that when we turn to Him, He will be with us here and hereafter. There's a part in the book that in the 12 and 12 that I hang on to. It says, I got to keep my head with God, but my feet firmly planted on the ground. I have struggled with that. I want my head with God, and I want the world to go away. It just doesn't work that way. I have to live in this world. You know, God's will, my will. There's lots of stories I can tell. I always tell a story of a woman who waited for her daughter to come into the program, and her daughter came into the program, and she picked up her one-year anniversary. And what ended up happening was, at the end of the meeting, she went downstairs. The daughter had to leave early to go back to work, and they saw the police outside, and there was a cop car out there, and the daughter was murdered. And she was an AA member for many years, and she was very upset. And she wanted, you know, she said, screw this acceptance stuff. And what ended up happening was her sponsor at that time was a guy by the name of Chuck Chamberlain out of California, Chuck C. And he knew Dr. Paul, that was his sponsor, was Dr. Paul Oliger, the one who wrote The Alcoholic Addict, and Acceptance is the Answer is now what it's called. And he went and said, I wanted you to talk to Dr. Paul. And what ended up happening was that they ended up going to a gratitude dinner together, and this woman sat next to Dr. Paul, not intentionally, and Chuck went over and said, I want you to tell Dr. Paul what happened, and they got into a discussion about God's will and human will. And what she said is God didn't want his daughter to die, but God gave men free will to use as they saw fit. And this man was not practicing God's will, he was practicing his own when he killed her. And in God's world, everything is perfect, but we don't live in God's world. We live here. And how do I get along with my fellow man? And I have to, you know, be cognizant that there are neighborhoods I won't walk in because I'll probably get taken out. So I have to be, God doesn't want me walking in those neighborhoods anymore. I used to live in those neighborhoods. So I got to remember that God's will is for me to be the best George I know how to be and try and help someone else, to give the love that was so freely given to me to another person, whether they want it or not. What they do with that message is none of my business. Hard for me to learn when I got here. So I get to this 11th step, and I practice prayer and meditation many ways. And I'll talk about that a little later. And now I get to the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, carrying the message to others and practicing these principles. Our distorted drives have been returned to something like their real and true purpose and direction. We no longer strive to dominate or rule those about us in order to gain self-importance. That's called control. That's an illusion that I had to get rid of. We no longer seek fame nor honor in order to be praised. When by devoted service to family, friends, business, and community, we attract widespread affection, and we sometimes are singled out for posts of greater responsibility and trust. We try to be humbly grateful and exert ourselves the more into the spirit of love and service. True leadership, we find, depends upon the able example and not upon vain displays of power and glory. As I shared many times in here, when I got to my steps, my three higher powers when I walked in this room was money, property, and prestige, which always kept me from the presence of God. It kept me running on self-will for all the wrong reasons. So, you know, I got to this 12th step, and we've been going through this journey, and we've been reading these promises every week. And if you've been here, you've been hearing me talk about prayers in the steps and different prayers. Well, if you stuck with me from the beginning of this, in the first 164 pages, there are 40 prayers in the 12 steps. You can go find them for yourself. There's a couple I use on a daily basis. But those prayers all mean something to me today. And I came in here not believing there was a God, or I didn't want prayer. And I didn't want this thing called recovery when I got here. I wanted to stop hurting, and I wanted my kids back in my life. So now I'm at this 12th step, trying to figure out what I got to do with my life and where it's taking me. So it says, the joy of good living is the theme of AA's 12th step, and action is the key word. We go back to the beginning. It says the first two steps, it was self-will that blocked us, and those were both mostly reflection, and we made our first real attempt at action in the third step when we made a decision to turn our will and life over to the care of God. Will and life, thoughts and actions, over to God. I had a lot of problems with that. But the action I took was to make a decision to do the third step. By doing the rest of the steps is how I did my third step. That was the deal I made with my sponsor. Here we turn out to our fellow actor who's still in distress. Here we experience the kind of giving that asks no rewards. We begin to practice all 12 steps of the program in our daily life so so that we and those about us may find emotional sobriety. We talked about that in step 10, that when we have a terrific hangover, whether we're drinking or not, we all have something called emotional sobriety, something that eluded us. When we're caught into the negative ways of yesterday and sometimes excesses of negative emotions. How do I stay emotionally sound? I do it through prayer and meditation, and like my sponsor said right at the very beginning, it's vital to permanent recovery that I work with another alcoholic. If I am to find that peace of mind that I so sought after in a bottle or in a girl or in spending or any other of my insane things that I did that was going to take me out of me and have me manipulate you, I needed to find a relationship with a power that I didn't understand when I got here. And he told me to go sit down with another drunk. I was sober 30 days. And what ended up happening is my sponsor asked me to go with him to a bar. And I went into a bar with him. He had something like 40 years at the time. And he said, I want you to go into the bar with me. And I looked in the bar and I can't do that. I got, 30 days. He says, yes, you can. You're with me. So I went into the bar with him. And what do you think I did? I watched the bottles going by me. I watched the drinks going by me. I was getting very thirsty. I knew that. And then I sat down with this guy that I don't even know the guy's name. I don't know if he ever found his way here or not. And he said, tell him your story. I said, Bob, you got, 40 years. He says, he'll relate to you better than he'll relate to me. So I told him my story, and I don't know what ever happened to him. But I knew one thing by the end of that night. Those guys that were laughing and having a good time when I walked in were fighting and arguing by the time I walked out. All right? It was ugly in the bar when I left, and I didn't want to drink. Now, that I know happened. What it did, it gave me a day of sobriety because I was with another alcoholic on the right motive. It was about my motive. Now, I didn't know whatever happened to that guy. I don't know if he's here today. I never ran into him again. But I'll tell you one thing. I had a lasting impression of why I didn't want to drink that night. That doesn't mean the thought didn't cross my mind and I didn't want to do it again, but that was my first 12-step call. Was it a success? I stayed drunk. I didn't stay drunk. The other guy was drunk. I stayed sober that night. And because I didn't drink that night, and I was with somebody else from this program, and I walked out, I had some peace of mind. Although I was crazy for 3 days later thinking about that bar, I just didn't drink. And then we talk about the different ways we have spiritual experiences. On page 164 in the big book, I'm going to jump around a little bit here. On page 164 in our big book, it states that at the very end of the thing, it talks about all the, about abandoning yourself to God as you understand God. Those are steps 1, 2, and 3. It says, admit your faults to him and to your fellows. That's steps 4 through 7. Clear away the wreckage of your past. That's 8 and 9. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you surely shall meet some of us as you trudge this road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you till then. That's steps 10, 11, and 12. So those steps are right there, right at the end of our reading, but I don't see the steps that way. I don't see anything clearly when I first get here. So how do I get to see that, having had a spiritual awakening? And like I said to my sponsor, what's the payoff? I know there's a payoff in AA. Where's the payoff? I'm here. I'm doing these steps. Where's the payoff? It says the way we get ready to receive this is we have to make ourselves ready. And it says AA is making ready to receive the gift lies in the practice of the 12 steps. So let's consider what we're trying to do up to this point. Step 1 showed us an amazing paradox. We found that we were totally unable to rid the alcohol obsession until we admitted we were powerless over it. In step 2, we saw that we could not restore ourselves to sanity. Some higher power must be necessary to do it if we were to survive. Consequently, in step 3, we turned our will and lives over to care of God as we understood him. For the time being, we who were atheists or agnostics have discovered that our own group or AA as a whole would suffice as a higher power. Beginning with step 4, we commenced to search out those things in ourselves which have brought us physical, moral, and spiritual bankruptcy. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory. Looking at step 5, we decided that an inventory taken alone wouldn't be enough. We knew we'd have to quit the deadly business of living alone with our conflicts and honestly confine these to God and to another human being. I believe we do a fifth step for 3 reasons. We go to God for forgiveness, we go to ourselves for understanding, and we go to another human being to practice humility. At step 6, many of us balked for the practical reason we do not wish to have all our defects of character removed because we love some of them too much. Yet we had to make a settlement with the fundamental principle of step six. So decided that while we still had some flaws of character we could not relinquish, we ought nevertheless quit our stubborn, rebellious hanging on to them. We said to ourselves, I cannot do this today, perhaps, but stop crying, no, never. Then in step seven, we humbly asked God to remove our shortcomings, such as he would or could under the condition of the day we asked. I think that's very important. I believe I was given a daily reprieve of my alcoholism contingent on my spiritual well-being. That's why I get up in the morning and I pray and I call a sponsor and I speak to another alcoholic and I go to a meeting. That's what I was taught to do. And I try to reach out and help others. That's the way I do that. I also believe I'm given a daily reprieve of my human frailties or my character defects. And it depends on how I go to God with them. If I'm walking around and I'm cheating on the person I'm with, or if I'm stealing, or if I'm lying, and I go to God and say, take it away, he ain't taking it away. I got to meet him somewhere here and say, okay, I got to stop lying, I got to stop cheating, and I got to stop stealing. When I start doing that, then God will meet me and maybe remove him. And I believe he doesn't remove all my character defects because he wants to teach some of you guys how not to behave. I believe that to my utmost. So I believe that some of them won't go away, and some of them take a long time. But I know the desire to drink and drug has been removed from me, and that's a gift from God. It's nothing I did. All I did was show up and did the work that was laid out. So we get to the A step. We continued our house cleaning, for we saw that we were not only in conflict with ourselves, but with always the people and situation in the world that we live. We had to begin to make our peace, so we listed the people we had harmed and became willing to set them things right. We followed this up in step nine by making direct amends to those concerned, except when to do so would injure them or other people. By this time, in step 10, we began to get the basis of daily living, and we keenly realized that we would need to continue taking personal inventory and that we were in the wrong. We ought to admit it promptly. In step 11, we saw that a higher power had restored us to sanity and enabled us to live with some peace of mind in a surely troubled world. Then such a higher power is worth knowing better by direct contact as possible. The persistent use of meditation and prayer, we found, did open a channel that which once would have been a trickle. There has been a new river which led to sure power and a safe guidance from God as we increasingly were better able to understand him. I want to tell a story now. I talked about me being sick for a while and my sponsor having me writing daily thoughts or daily meditations. I do a lot of quiet time or meditation time, and I write a lot. And part of my 11th step is that I write a daily thought and I send it out. It started with three people. As of last night, I think it's 396 people get that. I don't know how many people send it to other people. I don't know who they send it to, and I don't know whose heart is being touched, but it's something I was taught to do because of what I needed to do in my early recovery. Or my early recovery. I was 6 years, I was 8 years sober when that started happening. I did that so I can reach out to others in a way that I didn't know I was going to be reaching out to them, and I became a published author out of this. That is something that I never would have expected when I got here. And I tell that story not to say, look at what I've done. It's to show you that God has entered in my heart, and the book says, which in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to do for me those things which I could have never have done for myself. I didn't want to write. I didn't want people close to me. I didn't want anybody, you know, to know who I was or what I was about. I was very secretive, and that's what I was. And through prayer and meditation, a channel was open that I found a new experience to do other things to help people that I don't even know I'm helping. And that's a gift from God. So it's about the love of my fellow man. Okay, so practicing the steps, we had a spiritual awakening. Now, the difference between awakening and an experience. An awakening is slow. You know, we get up, we kind of stretch and yawn, and we awaken. An experience is something that happens suddenly. Like if you're in a car accident, you're having an experience. If you drop 10 tabs of acid, you're having an experience. May not be very spiritual, but it's an experience. Eat too many pills, they got to empty your stomach, you're having an experience, one you're not going to forget. Those are experiences, and I've had a few of those. Not all of them are positive. So out of those experiences, I get an education so I can help somebody maybe down the road not to walk down and make the same mistakes I did. So God has graced me with the ability to live through a lot of terrible things, you know. I have a very bad lungs, and somebody asked me before the meeting how I'm doing. I'm doing okay today, whatever that means. I'm on the upside of good or the upside of okay. And I was talking to somebody earlier about, they were asking me, how did I get sick? Well, I worked in the movie industry, and I worked in movie theaters. And if you know anything about movie theaters, they are in the old days, they used to have carbon-off lamps. And being that I did certain substances that had a smell and I didn't want to lose my job, I would open up the lamp house and I would smoke whatever it was I was smoking and blow it into the lamp house. But at the same time, there's carbon dust in there. And that carbon dust has definitely infiltrated my lungs. And I did that for a lot of years. I was in the industry for 33 years, and I was getting high for 33 years, and I was drinking for the 33 years I was there. So whether I take my alcohol in the form of powder or a pill or liquid, or I inject it or I swallow it, it doesn't matter. Is it, what does it do for me from the neck up? And the behavior that I rationalized actually hurt my body, and I never saw anything wrong with it. Until they did all these tests on me, and they say, well, you've got some carbon in your lungs. Did you ever work in the industry? And then they ran like 400 tests on me, and I'm not sick enough to have mesothelioma, so I can't get that. And I'm not sick enough to have black lung disease, but I have things going on in my body, and it is a direct result of my alcoholism. When I cut my hand, in 2006, I came down with hepatitis C and cancer. Now you know where I got the hepatitis C from. It's not rocket science. I shared a needle with other people. It was doing my alcohol in the needle. For you guys that belong to another fellowship, get over it, because you know this is my experience, and it's my alcohol in another form. Now I don't say that because if there's a pure alcoholic in this room and they think because they only did alcohol, they can't relate to me. Please don't get hung up on what I did. Try and find somewhere where you can look at it and identify with the feelings and stuff that I did to myself because I thought I was unique and different, and it was never going to affect me. Well, it did. And those are things that I got to do being uniquely different, and I came in here wanting to be different. So I had a couple of awakenings along the way. Like somebody said, your uniqueness will kill you. Stop being unique, you're just another drunk. I used to, when I first came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I identified myself as a compulsive addictive person who happened to have a substance abuse problem. Somebody said, get over it, you're a drunk. You're a drunk and a junkie who needs help. And until you let go of those old ideas, you're going to stay sick. I was pretty new in the program, and I didn't want to stay here. So, you know, we talk about how we get these awakenings. I'm really grateful for the people who were before me. I went to a guy, and I was telling him about how different I was. And he says, you know, you're miserable in Alcoholics Anonymous. Here's $20. Go get drunk. So I stayed sober under resentment. You know, for the first couple of weeks, I came back every day, and I said, I got you $20. I'm not going to use the language. I'm back. And then I started liking Alcoholics Anonymous, so I started staying sober on fear because I didn't want to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I got started staying sober on the steps, and then I got sober on the fellowship. I used every excuse in the world but to ask God in. And I was not comfortable in my own skin for my first 9 months of recovery until I started getting a relationship with a God that I didn't want when I got here from people I didn't like to show me things I didn't want to do, and I did them anyway. And by doing that, something changed. And it changed somewhere between step 4 and step 10, where I started getting a relationship with the God of your understanding or the God of my misunderstanding. I don't even get hung up on it anymore. I used to talk about it. And if anybody doesn't know what it is God. Period. And if that scares you, don't let it, because if that scares you out of the room, alcohol will scare you back in you. This is all about a relationship with God. And I had none when I got here. The 12th step is, how do I keep that relationship with God? The only way I know how to keep a relationship with God is giving it to somebody who don't want it the same way I didn't, and go through the same nonsense that I did, and listen to the same excuses I gave until I watched the light go on. There's a part in our literature that says, to watch someone move from darkness to light is an experience you won't want to miss. And that's so true. I've watched people light up in this program. I watched people do things that they never thought they were capable of. I watched myself go through struggles and get gifts beyond anything I could ever imagine. One of my children back in my life. And the ability to deal with my other one would not in my life without drinking and drugging over it. Without trying to do all the harm that I've always done to myself. So, there is a solution. It says, the great fact is this and nothing less. That we have deep and effective spiritual experience which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. Now, that revolution came through me doing the work that was laid out by my sponsor. And because I did the work, and it talks about a little further on, I got lit up. I like to say my imagination was fired. It talks about it in the big book. The central fact in our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we can never do for ourselves. God entered my life in a way that I've learned to match serenity with all the calamity that goes on. And I have a lot of calamity in my life still, not because I'm sober. It doesn't mean that there's still things that don't happen. There's still physical issues. There's still mental issues. I still go through all kinds of stuff. Stuff happens. That's what do I do with that stuff? How do I get to be at peace with myself, with my fellow man, and with God? Because I wasn't at peace with God when I got here. I had all the excuses of why I didn't want God in my life. The truth was, I didn't want God in my life because I spit in his face for so long. And then I said to him, you ain't going to help me because I ain't worthy of your help. That's my experience. I'll tell you along the way, when I finally surrendered that and asked for the help, and a sponsor put my hand in his and then led me to a God of his understanding, which became the God of my understanding, which had nothing to do with my religious upbringing. Today, I look to see where religious people are right. Now, that's something that was a whole battle that took years for me to get over. All those things are there for a reason. They're all in place. There is no such thing as non-AA literature. I love that one. I always love when we talk about conference approved, non-conference approved. I've quoted a lot of things from a lot of different people. A lot of it is not conference approved, but yet it's AA approved literature because they use it in other parts of this country. The Four Absolutes is one of the things we were talking about. I use that regularly. And that's AA literature. We don't use it here, but it doesn't mean it's not AA. For a long time, Group One in Akron used to use the Bible. They used to do a Bible reading before the meeting. And then they used to have discussions on that. That is just as much AA literature to me as it is. I wouldn't go into an AA room to go hear the Bible. I would rather go to church or a temple to go hear that message. But that's what they used to do. They talk about James. They talk about the Corinthians. They talk about Emmett Fox. That's all the stuff that the old timers used, and all of it works. So whatever your journey is to find your experience, don't hesitate to see where all of us who have been around use that stuff. And if it applies, please use it. And if it doesn't apply, just let it fly. It's not that important. You will find an answer. But you have to be here long enough without drinking to find that answer. So it says, practically every A member who had no satisfaction has a deeper and no joy greater than 12-step work, well done. What is well done 12-step work? That I walk out there and I don't drink with whoever I'm talking to. That's a good 12-step call. That's it. I try not to do them alone. I've done them alone. It's not recommended. I've done them because I've gotten a call at 4 o'clock in the morning and there's nobody else around. I've called people. I've went with people. I did it without people. I would rather do it with someone because my disease, I don't know when it's going to get me. But it says in our literature that when we're spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things we're not supposed to. So I make sure I'm pretty spiritually fit. I ask God to go in. And if I can't take God wherever I'm going, then I don't belong in there. It's really that simple for me. There's a part in our literature where it says that someone who was doing, when we were under investigation by someone who was a therapist, he once said, most of the alcoholics under investigation were still childish, emotionally sensitive, and grandiose. And if you know anything like me, I'm childish, I'm sensitive, and I'm grandiose. I can walk in this room and tell 10 people are going to tell me what a good job I did. And as I'm walking out, I say, you know, I got nothing out of that. I'm going to think all night long of what I should have said to that guy that he could have heard me. I didn't hear the other 9 anymore. They just disappeared. So you tell me 10 good things, you tell me 1 bad thing, I'm going to focus on the bad. Because that's my walk thinker. I mean, I still have that. And the grandiosity, my sponsor used to say to me, George, if you're going to go out and take everybody for coffee, it would really be advisable if you got a job first. But that's the way I thought. You know, let me show everybody how important I am. Not that important. We alcoholics didn't resent that verdict. We would not believe that that our adult dreams were often truly childish. I had some very weird perceptions when I got here of what I thought I really wanted. Had I got what I wanted, I don't know if I'd be sitting here today, but I definitely got what I needed. God graced me with a lot of things in here. Not what I asked for. None of it what I asked for. Some of it, not, but not all of it. I asked for certain things at the beginning, like a bed, a roof, and a full night's sleep. I got the bed and the roof, then the full night's sleep took about 6 months. But I got to that eventually. Now I don't sleep again because I get up in the middle of the night, I can't breathe, and I won't go back to sleep because I'm afraid to go to sleep because I'm afraid I'm going to have to go on oxygen or onto one of my machines, and I don't like the way that feels. So I sit up and I read and I write and I pray and I talk to God and I tell him to take it away, but he's not going to because it's a physical ailment that I have. So I have to learn to live with it. My quality of life has changed. But, and I'm not mad at God at it for it or anybody else. It's something I live with. And I've learned to live with what I've got. And then I got this other part of me that talks about my pride. You know, we talk about fear and faith can't be in the same place at the same time. Let me just tell you I don't believe that's true. My experience tells me that's not true. Our literature says that false pride became the ruinous side, the other of the coin marked fear. The other side of fear is false pride. I can have fear and faith at the same time in the same place. My experience has proven it to me more than once. If it doesn't, again, if it doesn't apply, let it fly, please. I came down, I was diagnosed with cancer at 6.5 years of sobriety. I lived through that cancer. If you don't think I was afraid during that time, you're surely mistaken. But I knew God was going to take care of me. At the same time, I cut my hand with a circular saw. I lost my ability to work. I lost a girlfriend. I was living in my car at 6.5 years of sobriety. God took care of me. And that was a message I carried to other people. I got very involved in going to more meetings. I got more busy with step work. I went and did more things in prayer and meditation to help myself get through it. And yet, God took care of me. And yet, I was wondering if I was going to live through all of that. And here again, I was scared to death, but I knew God was going to take care of me. So I had faith and fear in the same place, at the same time, at the same moment. But with that faith and fear, I did the things I was taught to do, which was to reach out to another alcoholic. And there's many people in these rooms have been through illnesses, chronic illnesses, besides the alcoholism. That's a chronic illness in itself, that have gone through cancer or a hepatitis. And they're hurting, and they don't share in the room. And with that, I was going to tell a story, and I'm going to tell that story. I'm going to read something. Because there's a story of a young woman. Now I'm going to read the story. It's more fun that way. Where is it? It should be here. Who's sitting next to you? You know, we reach out to people we know. We all communicate with everybody. We kind of stay together and talk to each other. But somebody new walks in the room, and a lot of us don't even say hello to them. I try and reach out to as many people as I can. I like to stand by the door to say hello to people and reach out to them. And there's a thing that I got, and I want to read this. This is just one of those things that means a lot to me because there's a lot of people that are in these rooms that are hurting, and nobody even knows they're hurting. And they sit here for an hour, and they walk out, and they're still hurting. And they haven't spoken to anybody because they don't know how to yet. Or they can't, or they won't, or whatever the reason is. If you're in these rooms and you see somebody, say hello. You may be the only example of the big book they'll ever see. Because they may go out and drink tonight and die. And I was told that when I got here. And it says, who's sitting next to you? I know who you are. You're an ex who attends the ABC meeting at the XYZ Club, and we meet anywhere in the USA. I saw you the other night at the 8 o'clock meeting. I didn't know how long you've been around, but I know that you've been coming around for a while because you spoke to a lot of people who knew you. I wasn't one of them. You don't know who I am. I wandered into your meeting, a place alone, the other night, a stranger in a strange town. I got a cup of coffee, paid for it, sat down by myself. You didn't speak to me. Oh, you saw me. You glanced my way, but you didn't recognize me. So you quickly averted your eyes and you sort of my eyes and sort of familiar face. I sat through your meeting. It was okay, slightly different format than basically the same kind of meeting that one that I have at home. The topic was gratitude, and you and your friends spoke about how much the program means to you. You talked about the camaraderie in your meeting place. You said how much the people there had helped you when you first came through the door, how you extended the hand of friendship to make you feel welcome and ask you to come back. And I wondered where they had gone. Those nice people who made your entrance so welcoming and so confident. You talked about how the newcomer is the lifeblood of the fellowship. I agree, but I didn't say so. In fact, I didn't share in your meeting. I signed my name in the book that was passed around, but the chairperson didn't refer to it. He only called on the people in the room that he knew. So who am I? You don't know because you didn't bother to find out. Although yours is a closed meeting, you didn't even ask if I belonged there. I might have been my first meeting, could have been full of fear, distrust, knowing this would work any better than anything else I tried, and I would have left convinced that I was right. I might have been suicidal, grasping the last straw, hoping someone would reach out and pull me from the pit of loathing and self-pity from which by myself I could not find escape. I might have been a student with a tape recorder in my pocket assigned to write a paper on how the program works, someone who shouldn't have been permitted to sit in at all but have been directed to an open meeting where I could have learned what I needed to know. Or I could have been sent by the courts wanting to know more but afraid to ask. It happens that I was none of the above. I was just an ordinary member of the fellowship with a few years in the program who was traveling and was in need of a meeting. My only problem with that night was that I had been alone with my own mind too long. I just needed to touch base with my family in recovery. I know from my past experience that I could have walked into your meeting place smiling, stuck out my hand to the first person and said, "Hi, my name is, and I'm from such and such a place." If I felt like doing so, I probably would have been warmly welcome. If you would have asked me if I knew so-and-so from my state, you might have shared some part of our experience that occurred in my part of the country. Why didn't I? I was hungry, lonely, and tired. The only thing missing was angry. But 3 out of 4 is not a good place for me to be. So I sat silently through your meeting. And when I was over, I watched enviously as you gathered in small groups talking to one another the same way you did in my hometown, the same way they did in my hometown. You and some of your friends were planning a meeting after the meeting in a nearby coffee shop. But this time, I had been silent too long to reach out to you. I stopped by the bulletin board to read the notices there, kind of hanging around without being too obvious, hoping you might ask if I wanted to join you. But I didn't. And I walked slowly across the parking lot to my car, the out-of-state license plates. You looked at me again. Your eyes met me briefly. I mustered a smile again. You looked away. I buckled my seatbelt and started the car. I drove to a motel where I was staying. I lay there in my bed waiting for sleep to come. I made a gratitude list. You were on that list, along with your friends in the meeting place. I knew that you were there for me and that I needed you far more than you needed me. I knew that I needed help, and had I asked you for it, you would have gladly given it. But I wondered, what if I hadn't been able to ask? I know who you are. Do you remember me? Anyone, anywhere, in any meeting in the United States. Now, I am grateful for the people who reached out their hand to me when I couldn't reach out my hand. It's a lot of us that can't do that when we first walk in here. We're hurting too bad. And I'm grateful for the people that made me reach out my hand to other people by standing at a door. You know, how do we carry the message? My sponsor had me standing at a door when I was brand new. And they used to say, ashtrays, brooms, and chairs. You used to have to get there early, set up the chairs, and have to greet people and make coffee, and then clean up the room. Having had a spiritual awakening, I got through doing the steps. Carrying the message is manifold. We all carried many messages. Sitting in a room like this, being here week after week, as two people I know have done, a couple of people, but two newcomers I know have done that, to me is a gift that I've been given. It touches my heart to watch some people that are brand new come in here to hear the message of hope. Not everybody says it every meeting. Not everybody hears everything in every meeting. We all get distracted. But the gift of carrying the message to someone else is that they're hearing something that somewhere in their recovery they're going to be able to give to somebody else, the same as I heard it. Some of the stuff took me years to unravel, and that's a gift that I heard when I first got here. It's really hard. How do I practice these principles in all my affairs? We're back to that word, principle. I'm going to try and do this quickly because we got 10 minutes. We started with the word principle in step one. What is a principle? A principle is a rule or code of conduct. Basic law or assumption. That's what a principle is. I walked in here with a lot of negative principles, and each week that we've been doing this, I've been going over principles. We hit this 12 step, and I'm going to show you, and I don't think I'm going to get a chance to read them all because I want to end with something of why we do what we do. Here are the principles. I'm going to go through them real quick. action, admittance, awareness, assets, amends, achieving, acceptance, adaptability, awakening, brotherhood, attitude, affection, belief, balance, belonging, blessings, beauty, conscience, confidence, courage, companionship, coping, calm, consideration, counsel, compassion, conviction, clarity, confession, correction, common sense, concern, caution, conversation, candor, choice, centered, character building, change, care, continuance, contact, comfort, contented, continuous, conditioning, discussion, discretion, desire, disclosure, dependence, determination, direction, discovering, decency, endurance, ego puncturing, effectiveness, esteem, evidence, exposed, effort, emotional balance, faith, fortitude, facts, forgiving, frankness, freedom, fair-minded, focus, foundation, God, grace, goodness, good judgment, good purpose, guidance, generous, glowing, good conscience, gratitude, good living, God dependence, hope, higher power, honest, house cleaning, healing, helpful, harmony, insight, humility, happiness, honesty, inventory, integrity, investigation, joy, justice, instinctiveness, just, judgment, kind, listening, kinship, knowledge, liberation, labor, motives, morality, morals, miracles, maintenance, meditation, objection, obedience, open-minded, practice, protection, persistence, practicing, principles, prayer, peace, prompt, preparation, purposeful, inventory, personal inventory, pause, prudence, quality, quiet, partnership, quiet time, rest, readiness, restitution, recognition, relief, realistic, responsibility, resolve, respectability, reassurance, repair, amend, restraint, reviewing, revealing, right objectives, revelation, sober, overhauling, sacrifice, straight thinking, spirituality, selfless, stock taking, sympathizing, steady, sobriety, self-reliance, sensible, self-forgetting, sanity, searching, strength, self-discipline, security, sober, seeking, spiritual values, sincerity, service, self-searching, self-examination, self-control, security, spiritual truth, steadfast, self-sufficiency, thoroughness, thoughtfulness, tact, usefulness, vision, vigilance, well-being, wisdom, wise, values, unity, understanding, truth, tolerance, spirit, security, solution, trustworthy, timely, thankful, useful, venture, willingness, and willing. Now, those are things that we've talked about and that I get to put into play after doing all 12 steps. Those are the positive principles. The 12 principles we see on a wall on a regular basis, those 12 words that are up on the wall somewhere around here, up on that wall back there, they work. If they work, please use them. What I was given is that the principle is the step. And from those steps, all these wonderful things have grown out of them. From doing all these 12 steps, that's what I have found in my journey. I want to end, and I really got to end, this is something I do want to read, but I want to read something from Dr. Bob. We started with Bill, as always, and I always like to end with Dr. Bob. Why do we do, how do we, you know, having had this person away and as a result of the steps, we carried a message to other alcoholics, and how do I practice these things in all of our fears? And the question is, why do I practice these things? Today I practice these things like Dr. Bob says. I spend a great deal of time passing what I have learned from others who want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. One, it's a sense of duty. Two, it's a pleasure. Three, because in doing so, I'm paying the debt to the man who took the time to pass it on to me. Four, because every time I do it, I take out a little bit more insurance for myself against a possible slip. Unlike most of my crowd, I did not get over my drinking or craving for liquor during the first 2.5 years. This is Dr. Bob. I had him 9 months. He had 2.5 years. He was almost always with me, but no time had I been anywhere near yielding. I used to get terribly upset when I saw my friends drink, and I knew I could not. My school myself to believe that though I once had the same privilege, I had abused it so frightfully that it was withdrawn. So it doesn't behoove me to squawk about it. For after all, nobody ever threw me down and poured liquor down my throat. If you think you're an atheist or an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride, which keeps you from accepting what's in this book, I feel sorry for you. If you still think you are strong enough to beat the game alone, that is your affair. But if you really and truly want to quit drinking liquor for good and for all, and sincerely feel that you must have someone, some help, we know we have the answer for you. It never fails. If you go about it with half the zeal you did when in the habit of showing when you were getting another drink, your Heavenly Father will never let you down. I will tell you that through my experience that I came in here not wanting to stop drinking. All I wanted was to stop hurting. I wanted my children back in my life. That's all I wanted when I got here. At 6 months, my children were taken out of my life, but the desire to drink was removed. Through the process of doing steps, through the love of a sponsor, through a fellowship that showed me a way to live that was far better than anything I would have ever imagined. And it had nothing to do with me except being willing to show up, able to do the work, and then do the work. It says to duplicate what we have found with such backing is only a matter of willingness, patience, and labor. And if you're like me, you're impatient. You want everything now. Time takes time. I'm here for a while. My recovery keeps changing. What changes in my recovery is how I perceive my God and what I do for others. I have no desire to drink today. Alcohol, the desire to drink has been removed from me. As long as I keep spiritually fit. How do I keep spiritually fit? By doing what was laid out in front of me. By taking another person's hand and putting them in the hand of the steps, and then through that putting them in the hand of God. And when they get to do that with someone else, is a remarkable thing that we just don't imagine that it'll ever happen. Because if you're a drunk and a junkie like me that comes out of a cardboard box from under a bridge, to be sober for one day is a miracle. To be sober for 18 and a half years is insane, because it should never happen to somebody like me. To live through illness, to live through children, to live through death, to live through all the trials and tribulations that each one of us has gone through, no matter what you're going through, somebody in this room has already done it. There is nothing new in Alcoholics Anonymous. What is new is what is the day that we have. That's all that's new. When I wake up tomorrow, I get a new day and a new shot at this. The best I'll ever have, the best I'll ever have is 24 hours. And that's only by God's grace. Mm-hmm. Thanks for letting me.